Welcome to On Par with Maury Povich. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to On Par with me, Maury Povich. Now, my guest today, his name is Mark Mulvoy. If you're maybe over the age of 40, you might have heard of Mark Mulvoy. Mark Mulvoy was the most decorated, celebrated editor of something called Sports Illustrated. If you're older than that, you might remember the first issue of the Sports Illustrated swimsuit issue. Well, it came out before Mark was the managing editor, but Mark had this great idea. Let's make it an annual. Not only did he do that, he quadrupled the profits of Sports Illustrated. So how did he get here? Well, we're going to find out, because welcome to my bestie of the last 30 years, one of my besties, Mark Mulvoy.
Thanks, Maury. Nice to be with you.
Was the intro good enough, or you want me to change it?
No, it's just the way I wrote it. I thought it was perfect.
I want to go back to the beginning, okay? You're from the Dorchester section of Boston, Massachusetts.
That's the Bronx of Boston, correct.
That's right, because not only that, you might not know this, but my dear son-in-law, Ralph Gorham, is from Dorchester and Dorchester Avenue. You know the place?
My street was right off Dodd Ave, Lonsdale Street, between St. Mark's Parish and Ashmont.
So there you go, Mark. Now, as I understand it, wasn't that Whitey Bulger land?
Well, Whitey was a Southie guy. Whitey actually grew up in the apartment next to the great sports writer Will McDonough. And so we played a lot of junior sporting events against Whiting as kids, and we learned never to leave our gloves on the field because they weren't there when we went back out. But the best story, I think, of Whitey is I invented the game of golf at Hyannisport Caddy Camp in 1955. I'd never been on a golf course. I was shocked day two of training when I found out they moved the pins on the green. I never knew that. Anyway, one of the kids in the tent was tent six at Hyannisport was a kid named Bill Barnoski. He was a thug. He'd go around giving you noogies and kicking you in the rear end and everything like that. And he's a real jerk. About 30 years later, I'm reading the Globe one morning. My kid brother Tommy was the editor of the Globe at that time. And I said, oh, my God. I called Tommy. I said, Tom, this guy who just went away for life for killing all these people is Whitey's trigger man. His name is Bill Barnoski. Can you find out if he was the Bill Barnoski from Somerville in 10-6? He called me about 10 minutes later. He says, that's him. By the way, how long do you think Whitey let the guy live in jail? He got an infection.
Oh, is that right?
Those things happened.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about this. I mean, you're Boston through and through. You went to Boston College High. You went to the Boston College. And not only did you go to Boston College, but somehow you started writing for the Globe while you were in college. How did that happen?
Well, one summer of 1960, I guess it was, I worked as a messenger boy at the Globe, the newspaper, taking ads all around to the ad agencies. And the sports editor was the great Jerry Nason. And I used to go in on Saturday morning and volunteer to answer the phones for him. You know, they'd ask these stupid questions. People would say, who threw out Enos Slaughter and stuff? I knew all the answers. And Jerry said to me, he said, come on in every Saturday. I did. And then I went back to BC and he hired me to be the campus correspondent. I worked nights, three or four nights a week at the Globe. I also was the student assistant sports information director. I had more jobs than you could ever imagine at BC. And, you know, then I was suddenly working on this. I joined the staff officially the day I graduated. But I also, the summer before, I had traveled out west with the Red Sox for a couple of weeks. So I had a great experience writing for the Globe. And then on April Fool's Day of 1965, I was hired and moved to New York for Sports Illustrated.
And we're going to get into that. But I'm going to guess your favorite sports to cover: baseball, golf, hockey.
Yes. I love baseball. You know, your dad loved baseball. It's hard not to love baseball. There was nothing better than after a game sitting with a Gene Mock or a Bill Rigney having dinner with him. And, you know, they're having a couple of scotches and you're reliving what happened in the game. And they're explaining some strategy. I mean, baseball had some great people to talk. I just love the strategical. And also, you know, at the Globe, I remember the first trip I made. You know, you're flying on a charter with the team, which we all did in those days. And you got to know the guys. I was young enough. I ran around with them. I remember Howdy Schilling, the second baseman of the Red Sox, says to me, hey, Bush, what do you make? I said, hey, Howdy, I'm just, you know, half a week out of college I'm making. 5,500. He says, yeah, I'm making the major league minimum, 6,700 bucks. I said, look at the gulf now. I mean, so in those days, we were all compatible a little bit. And of course, we had that expense account, which helped out. But now, second baseman makes 19 million.
You're so true about that. I mean, I can remember my father when he was working at the Post, the Washington Post. He was making kind of like the same money that the minimum salary was for the players in the major leagues, because everybody has to be a little older than, you got to be alive around 1975. There was something called the reserve clause. And basically, you signed up with a team, you signed up for life.
Exactly. And, Marvin Miller changed that. And, why he's not in the Hall of Fame is one of life's great mysteries. He did more to improve the game of baseball than anybody in history. I mean, the fact that the reserve clause disappeared, the transfer of players, which is now happening in college, I think, is destroying college sports. But the transfer certainly invigorated baseball. Just like, in the 90s, all those guys hit all those home runs and, Bud Selig and the game prospered like heck. But yet don't mention them in the Hall of Fame. Oh, my God, it's a sin.
So when we get to Sports Illustrated, after a really good run at the Globe, you somehow, and this is what one of the reasons why you're famous and maybe one of the reasons why you ended up being the editor, you get behind the Iron Curtain into the Soviet Union to report on all their hockey teams and players. And nobody was able to get behind the curtain of the Soviet Union at that time.
No, we were fortunately, I was the what made the impetus for that was the greatest sporting event I've ever covered was the 1972 Canada-Russia hockey series. First time they had ever met at that level. Four games in Canada, September 2, 4, 6, 8. Four in Moscow, September 22, 4, 6, 8. Canada wins the series 4-3 with a tie with 34 seconds to go in game 8 in Moscow, which was one of the great party nights in history. But before that, I had, through the Time Inc. Bureau in Moscow, had arranged that I went over and spent some time with the Soviet Central Army Club, which is the major training grounds for all Soviet Olympic class athletes, and had a fantastic time. I wrote about it, and I went back two other times to write. I went and spent a week covering hockey games in the league. I went over to Chelyabinsk and all these godforsaken towns and had a great time. But I love the Soviet players, They come to the States one time, Sports Illustrated, not me. I think I spent $700 at Corvettes buying jeans for them. They're all 12 bucks.
Oh, they love jeans.
I took them right. They had a practice up here, and I piled a bunch of them into my car, and off we went to Corvettes, which doesn't even exist now, I don't believe, and got jeans. But I got along with them, and it was really one night, one of the three great left wings in the history of the game is a guy named Alexander Yakushev, who's finally in the Hockey Hall of Fame. And one night he invites me out to his house for dinner with his wife, Katia, who's a philologist, and his daughter, and also the babushka, the grandmother. Their apartment, Marty, was about the size of Connie's closet. That's all I can tell you. And there were four people in it. And I don't know how in God's name they ever squeezed everybody. But we had a fantastic dinner. He was content. I kept saying to him, if you played for the Rangers, you'd be on Park Avenue. He says, I'm happy here. And they were happy there in those days. Of course, times changed. And in those days, the NHL players weren't making that much money. Fact of the matter is, if you look at hockey, there will be a player in the NBA within the next, I keep telling Adam Silver, within the next 2 years, perhaps, who's going to make more money than an entire National Hockey League team, which has a cap this year of, $94 or $5 per team. There are NBA players making $70 million now.
National Hockey League teams are at around $94, $95 million a year.
Exactly, for the team.
Yeah, for the team.
Yeah.
That's 4 million players making 70.
Right, in basketball. I mean, the Celtics they were $300 million over the salary cap or something, where they had to dismantle their team. I mean, the whole thing. I don't know who their accountants are, but they could keep you and me out of jail for a long time.
All right. Let's talk about how you become the youngest editor at Sports Illustrated at the age of 43.
Well, Gil Rogan, who was a brilliant editor, they asked him to go and run Discover magazine, which was having problems, and Gil was probably the only one who could do it. And they had a little contest among three of us, his three assistants, to do it. And I did some things. I had some ideas that I wanted to redesign the magazine. I wanted to run bigger pictures. Fewer
And
pictures.
you also started the Sports Illustrated Kids edition.
Right, started that later. But the whole point I wanted the magazine to be and turned it into, at that time, sports was a different place. Somebody had to be the conscience of sports. The television networks had all sold out to the leagues, to the colleges. They were all in bed with everybody, so never was read or heard a discouraging word. I mean, there were great stories to be done. So when I got the job, I mean, we ended up doing the whole Pete Rose thing. I mean, baseball, Faye Vincent would tell you, they learned more from us than they ever learned from their own research. We did the cocaine menaces that pervaded professional sports at that time, all the academic abuses in the college, and those alphabet organizations, the NCAA, the IOC, the USOC, and the soccer people. I mean, they're as crooked as you can imagine. And nobody was paying attention. They were giving them billions of dollars for television rights. So, they weren't doing the type of reporting and reportage. The Washington Post did so well with Watergate. And so that to me was our mission, was really to be the conscience of sport. And that was all rewarded. Mind you, I had a great pool of writers and reporters and investigators.
I was going to say, I mean, you had Jenkins, you had Wright,
Uh,
you had Kirkpatrick, you
that
had.
had all the great, Frank DeFord was there, Armand Cattaine, the great reporter. I hired Rick Riley, I hired Tommy Verducci, I hired Peter King. I mean, we had the greatest of all staffs, as you could imagine.
One of the reasons why the people at Time did not mess with you was that you came up with this idea. Wait a minute, if we had that swimsuit issue, why don't we make this an annual? Why would we just have it once? And you quadrupled the profits for the magazine, which meant that Time could give a shit what you did.
The great thing about being the editor of Sports Illustrated is we worked a different week. We worked Thursday to Monday when the weekends, all the other people were off at the Hamptons somewhere or skiing. They didn't bother us. They didn't know what the hell we were doing. And we just did it. I mean, when I did Sid Finch, which is still the greatest Fourth of
Yeah,
April
that's
Fool's
the
joke.
April Fool's. Oh my gosh! When you did that, maybe you ought to be maybe you ought to tell everybody how
Well,
that came about.
When you're the editor of a magazine, you know every issue date. I woke up early in January. I was looking over the year. And I said, "Oh my God, April 1st is April Fool's Day, and it's a publication date." So I went in the next day and I said to Myra Gelband, who was my outside editor, I said, "Get George in here. Let's come up with an idea for
This
April."
is George Plimpton.
George Plimpton, fabulous, fabulous writer, fabulous human being. God rest his soul. And it took about a month, but we came up with an idea and sent George off. And George came back and said, "Here's what I'd like to do." Once George had an idea, you said, "Go," and you get out of the way. And he invented this baseball pitcher, Sid Arthur Finch, from the Himalayas somewhere, threw the ball 162 miles an hour. And I ran a 12-page story on April Fool's Day. We had all the New York papers running around in St. Petersburg trying to find it, and nobody could find it. And of course, 2 days later, we fessed up. But I'll never forget Peter Jennings on Monday night on ABC. Said, "Folks, we always like to do something to have fun with you, our readers, and April Fools. But what Sports Illustrated did this week, nobody will ever even match." He gave us about 11 minutes of national television on the case of Sid Finch. But the great thing about it, nobody knew about it. I mean, when they found out what it was, some people in Time Inc., including the publisher, and were furious at me. Of course, within about 48 hours, the word had changed. The world loved it. They understood it. George Vesey wrote a column in the Times saying, "Thank God someone's having some fun." And it all turned around. But I never told anybody. I had one deal I was supposed to tell the one boss I had, the editor of Time Magazine, of the whole company. I didn't tell him. So, could have got fired.
That's okay. That's okay. You quadrupled the profits of the magazine because of that swimsuit edition. Let me ask you about this because you knew these models. You went. You were there when they did the pictures, pictorials. So, Elle Macpherson, you went to Australia, didn't you?
I didn't go to Australia with her. I went to Thailand with her and various other places. What I do is I'd make it, we, one year we do it around the world. The next year we do it relatively locally, Bermuda, Mexico, and places like that.
Here were the ones that you remember: Christie Brinkley, Cheryl Teagues, and Paulina Porizkova, right?
Marina Porizkova is still in New York now. Husband, I guess he died, didn't he? Rick Ocasek. Yeah. And Stephanie Seymour and Elle Macpherson. And the greatest of all is Kathy Ireland, who's a billionaire today. A billionaire.
Because of that magazine.
Well, that sort of jump-started her career and got her into the businesses where she's made all that money. I mean, she's in a league with you.
Hey, yeah, right. So If the owners right now of Sports Illustrated called you up, said, "Mark, we really want to see you. We want to talk to you. What can we do to kind of reestablish something that has become a shell?"
Well, you know, it's a monthly publication. I actually just read the most recent issue. They had some interesting stories, but then the issue before that was all about what athletes wear, the clothing that athletes wear is about 40 pages, which sort of baffled me. But you know, the problem is, we can do, the bigger question, Maury, is journalism dead? And the journalism that your dad practiced, that you practiced when you're a newsman, that Connie practiced, that I think my days at Sports Illustrated, it's dead. The internet has sort of killed off so much of it. And you know, just recently, this like the NFL is now owning 10% of ESPN. The leagues all have partnerships with everybody.
So
They
you
won't.
don't think that ESPN will have a repertorial staff that will take on the league?
I don't believe that at all. I mean, there's something happened the other day. Spike Lee was doing a movie on
Right.
Colin Kaepernick.
Right.
They scrapped it the other day.
Yeah.
Now,
You
he's
know
a
what they
con.
said? You know what they said? There were some creative differences.
Creative differences, yeah. Who are the differences with? I mean,
Yeah.
you know, I'm not pointing fingers, but I think the day of doing that type of story, it's, hey, you know, in the old days, we spent Pete Rose. I had two or three people who spent months on the whole story. Today's economy doesn't permit some publication to commit that type of resources and that type of money to do the types of stories that we miss. It's a scary everywhere. Look what what happened in the White House yesterday. I don't know whether you saw that press conference, but it was stacked with all of the president's particular favorites. There were about six Fox people. Marjorie Taylor Greene's boyfriend was in there representing somebody, and they were asking about, I don't know, climate change or everything. Well, the real journalists in the room wanted to know about what happened at the meetings. So this is what's happening everywhere. They're stacking it against honest journalism, which scares the hell out of me, and it's a sad commentary.
So, as I understand it, you left SI. By the way, you left in the 90s. I mean, you were still young, but you left. And the reason you gave was Sports Illustrated and maybe other publications weren't prepared for the internet.
That is totally true. There are three. Well, first of all, I wanted to do three things. I wanted to play senior competitive golf like you were doing and having a lot of fun. I was going to teach, which I did up at Fairfield University for a couple of years. I was prohibited from going on boards, and I had two offers to go on very good corporate boards. I had a home in Florida in the winter. I wanted to live down there. But there was a meeting at Time Inc. when Don Logan, who ran Time Inc., they asked him about this new thing, the internet, and he said, "It reminds me of the black hole." Well, that sent a message within Time Inc. to all the publishing side people and the business people that if the boss is not interested, why should we be? That's why Time Inc. doesn't exist today, because all of the publications were years and years behind everybody else when it came time. But there was another thing that happened before that. Jerry Levin, back in the 80s, Bob Miller, the publisher of SI and I, Bob presented the case that we could have bought the 24.5% of ESPN owned by Getty for about the bottom line of SI that year, give or take $100 million. Levin said no, he's going to put up a satellite for something. All I can tell you is it was bought by Hearst. I've been told that over the last 30 years, Hearst has made, they have made, give or take, $24 or $5 billion on that $100 million investment.
So, when you were managing editor of SI, I think you told me how many times was Michael Jordan on the cover?
About 35, give or take.
Yeah,
We
and
don't
yet
talk.
I know I, that's what I wanted to get to. Why aren't you friends?
Well, 34 of the covers were absolutely laudatory. You know, Phil Knight loved them. Billy Smithberg, who ran Gatorade, everybody, all his sponsors love him. Michael this, Michael that, Sportsman of the Year, you know, honest journalism. Well, Michael went and played baseball, and he couldn't hit you or me. And he's playing in Birmingham. The best thing he did, I think, was drive the players around on a but bigger buses than the ones the team provided. Anyway, I knew that I had been told by a very reputable person that Jerry Reinsdorf was going to bring him up to Chicago one weekend, fill the ballpark in Chicago with 200,000 people, charge God knows what to see Michael go about 0 for 12. To me, I'm sorry, that's not part of the integrity of the game. And so I walked in one day and I said, I want to do a story on Michael, and here's the cover is going to be Bagot. And that's what it was. To me, you don't do that. You know, that would be like all of a sudden this week in the World Golf Championship, in the thing they say, oh, Maury Povich is a good guy. He's a 5 handicap. He should come out and play too at 7,500 yards. Good luck. You shoot 90.
So, I mean, did Michael even attempt to talk to you?
No, Michael made it quite clear at the time that he had been finished talking with Sports Illustrated, and Jack McCallum, the great basketball writer. Now, if Jack were doing a story and asked a question like what day it is, Michael would probably say Tuesday, but there was no in-depth, conversation of any kind. And, he has that golf club down there. I went down there and played it once, but I'm not interested. You know, that's 30 years ago, too.
So you haven't ever been in touch in the last 30 years?
No. No reason.
Anybody else hate you because of what you did to them?
Jack Nicklaus, and I was his ghostwriter.
Jack Nicklaus? I mean, you...
No, no, he was mad one time because when I put his son on the cover, actually, I think Jack liked it. I lost a cover. You know, Sunday afternoon, something happened. I lost a story. It happened. Oh, my God. I put Gary Nicklaus on the cover, called him the new or next Nicklaus. Barbara was furious, and I think that's why Jack told me he didn't like it. But I think Jack actually liked the idea. What they didn't like was that among the pictures in the magazine, Gary was out on a boat with a couple of very young bikini-clad women on Palm Beach Island somewhere. So, no, not really.
Here's what everybody who watches this podcast ought to know about Mr. Mulvoy. And I've said this to his face. He's the biggest name dropper I have ever met, but he knows them all.
I have a granddaughter who's on her way to Vienna, Nick, this week to finish in her third year here at Wake Forest. And when she was down in Florida with us this winter, and all of a sudden I was mentioning your name or whosoever's name, and she reached down and I said, "What's the matter?" She says, "I'm just picking up all these names you just dropped."
This, one of the reasons why I love Mark is he has this amazing family. He and his wife, Trish, have been married well over 50 years.
57.
I'm 57.
57.
Four great kids. How many grandkids?
10.
Okay. And they all, of course, came to Montana one time and we had to host them up here. There was about 27 of Mulvoys all over the place.
It was great. Thank you for the hospitality and the food.
And what I love, I mean, what I admire about you and your family, you and Trish, you are devout Catholics. You observe your religion, to the nth degree. And I don't know if many people do that anymore, especially people of our age.
Right. Well, I think you're right there. I mean, I notice at church on Sunday, it's the old hardliners like myself who still go. And I mean, in my own family, I have one devout Catholic, my daughter Kelly and her husband Jim, but the others, Tommy lives in Switzerland with his wife and seven-year-old ski guy. And I think his God is somewhere in the sky on the slopes. Chrissy goes to, I believe, a Methodist church now. And Duke, I know he plays golf at Garden City on Sundays.
By the way, takes after you too, Dookie. Well, every time I see Dookie, he's around some celebrity.
Oh, you know where he was this weekend? He was up at the last 2 days up at Cabot Links. I told him about our life trip there. I said, make sure you do this. He was up at Cabot Links with some, of course, on a private plane.
Yeah, of course. I don't know. Do you miss it? Do you ever miss it? Do you ever miss the action? I mean, I do. I mean, I miss the action when there's an event.
Hmm. You know what? I'm what? You're 86, I guess, now. I turned 84 the other day. I don't miss it because this generation is not my generation. You know, I go, I watch the games. I don't enjoy them as much as I thought I would most of the games.
Oh, yeah. Oh, that's bullshit. You watch the Red Sox every night.
Well, the Red Sox are different. They're in a different world. But I can't watch the Mets. I mean, they've lost 80 of the last 90 or something like that. No, you miss it to a degree, but I don't miss the deadlines. I mean, you know, I'd write 35 stories a year for Sports Illustrated, and it was probably 40 nights up all night in a hotel room in Buffalo or Calgary or some godforsaken Prague, wherever it might be. I mean, I loved it at the time, but I wouldn't want to go through that again, too. And also, the access that we had to athletes doesn't exist anymore. And
it's unbelievable.
I don't know how you do it.
I mean, if when I was at a I was at a Nationals game a couple of years ago, and so before the game, I went on the field. I mean, my God, I thought I was going to be arrested. I
Yeah.
mean, it's ridiculous.
Well, not only that, you want to. I mean, I'm doing a story on Maury Povich, say of the Reds, and all of a sudden, I want to say, can you have dinner one night with you? What? They're not going to have dinner with you. And if you do talk to them, the PR guy is going to it'd be part of the conversation. If you talk to them too long and they're taking pictures, they're going to put the Reds thing behind for the picture guy to have, the Reds logo behind it. I mean, it's so contrived. I call it Pravda. I call it Komsomolskaya Pravda, which is the youth paper in Moscow. To me, what's happening in sports is because the sports media has become Pravda, and the way the journalists are treated, they're not allowed to into places. They're not wanted, and that's the
Do you
real.
know, who I think is doing a pretty good job? Is The Athletic. I don't know if
Athletic is yeah, it's really good. It was started by. Actually, just called while we were talking. Paul Fichtenbaum, who worked for me and with me at Sports Illustrated, and he launched it. He's removed himself once the time's gone. They do a very good job.
Yeah, I read an article recently. Talk about somebody who's been able to reinvent himself. Andrew Luck was a kind of, it's a tragic story about what happened to him in the NFL after 6 or 7 years, and how unbelievable pain he endured and had to quit. And now he becomes the general manager of the Stanford football team and hires who else but Mr. Reich to be the interim coach of the
Coach.
Stanford Cardinal.
Exactly. I wonder how interim that will be. I mean, that's the direction they're all going. All these teams. Look at, I mean, our sports writer, what's his name, Wisniewski or whatever his name, became the athletic director, the basketball general manager up at St. Bonaventure or somewhere.
Right.
It's happening everywhere, and this is what it's become. Bill Belichick, I mean, people say, how he's going to recruit? He's not recruiting. Michael Lombardi is finding kids and say, we're going to give you $400,000 to be an offensive tackle here at Carolina. You want to come? Oh, we got another kid over here for $399.
Well, at least they're trying to put a cap on it
What cap?
of the NIL. They're going to try to put a
Well,
cap.
they're trying, but how much money do you think that Cooper Flagg made this past year when you added it up? $37 million.
Oh yeah, because he was a number one pick. I think he made about 25 million on that alone.
Well, he got 12 apparently from the Duke nil. He got another between New Balance and somebody else. He got another 25. It's not a bad gig.
Yeah. And of course, he only spends a year in college.
But that's the real problem. I love this Terry Pegula, who owns the Buffalo team, whose daughter's the tennis player. Now, Penn State's never had a nice little hockey program. He built a rink. The number one draft pick in the NHL next year is a kid, I forget his name, McKenna, I think it is. And they gave him $700,000 to play what will be 1 year for Penn State. I want to tell you
As
something.
a hockey player.
There's a hockey puck. I mean, give me a break.
By the way, you're so dear to hockey, everybody should know this. They put you in the NHL, in the Hockey Hall of Fame.
True, as a journalist, as an appreciation, as they said, for my longstanding journalistic contributions to the game, Scotty Bowman had a funny line. He says, this would happen 25 years ago, but they had to wait for all the guys you pissed off to die.
Talking about name dropping, I mean,
Yep, I got to pick up that.
Bobby Orr, Ken Dryden. I mean, you did even did books with them.
Right, I did. Do you ever see Bobby in Florida? He's down
No,
there
but I used to see Bobby
on the Cape.
at Old Sandwich,
Yeah,
which is in Plymouth, Mass.
he's left there.
Oh, he did.
He's left there. He's gone down to the Greenville to the mountains of Carolinas. He's abandoned, left Massachusetts for good. And he's gone to the mountain. He comes up for some reason, but he's Jupiter Hills in the
You know
Carolinas.
what I found over the years, because I played a lot of golf with hockey players. First of all, they're terrific in terms of golf. They're the most approachable pro athlete I've ever been around. And I think it's all about money.
It is because they never had any. You know what I mean? Their idea of money is what LeBron tips. You know what I mean? And I say that with affection. They're great people. I mean, I've been in Flin Flon, Manitoba for Bobby Clark Weekend. You ever hear of Flin Flon, Manitoba is named after a legendary mining character named Hosiah Flin Tabbity Flonathan. It's 500 miles north of Winnipeg. I mean, I spent a weekend up there with Bobby. I never had a better weekend. The people were so real, so nice. You go places like that and you say that these are real, real nice people.
So this is called On Par. So we better talk about our golf days. Everybody ought to know that If Mark Mulvoy invites you on a golf trip, it is so special you wouldn't believe it. He has honchoed the best golf trips ever. We went to Southport, England one year. We played Birkdale. We played Royal Lytham and St. Anne's. We played Hoylake. We played Formby. We played more Hinsdale. We played more great golf than any other place. And you had it all worked out. You
And I
had.
couldn't, and I never played because I had my kidney stone attack. I played two rounds. Jeez. I've been back. I've been there before.
You love to plan trips. You always do, even with, I mean, especially with your family.
We had a group of about 16 guys. We called ourselves the Irish Open. We all joined the Apawamis Club here in Rye about the same time. And I put together trips. One year I took 60 people to the British Open at St. Andrews. We went to Ballybunion for the long weekend. Then we went over and set up headquarters at the Caledonian Hotel and went all over, played Muirfield everywhere, went to the first round of the Open.
There's an older group of men. You have to be, I guess you have to be at least a senior amateur golfer and pretty decent. So Mark became the president of the Society of Seniors. And when Mark does something, all of a sudden, we were on courses that we have never been on before.
Well, you know, when you have connections and you've maintained those connections and you've done the quid pro quo with those connections, you know, it's like people, Arnold Palmer said to me once, he said, "I don't understand why the Sports Illustrated plane is number one in line to get out of here on Sunday night." I said, "Well, go talk to the flight controllers and ask them how they like the Super Bowl or the World Series or something
Right.
like that."
Mark could give away tickets from
That's what
Sports
you did.
Illustrated. I mean, you were the best at it.
Well, look at the trip, which we don't talk about, a couple of years ago when we can't mention any names of the greatest golf trip ever when I played Pine Valley, Cypress Point, and Augusta the same day. That wasn't bad.
In one day,
Yeah, you
within
knew.
24 hours.
We
Wait a
played
second. Pine Valley, that's in New Jersey.
at 5:10 in the morning.
Yeah,
We
and
teed
then
it
you
up.
went, and then,
Dookie, of course, was with us, and we had lighter balls.
and when,
We
where's the next stop?
jumped on the plane. Walked right off the course, right into the Pine Valley van, right onto the plane to Augusta. We had Augusta members with us, of course. We walked right on, and I walked 52 or 54 holes. We finished up at Augusta about 2 o'clock. Get on the plane at 2:45, which was 11:45 West Coast time. We landed in Monterey at 4. We were on the first tee at 5. Finished at 8. We could have played another 6 holes. Then, because the pilots couldn't fly till noon the next day, we played Cyprus again in the morning.
Oh boy,
Why not?
something. You are something. I mean, Mark. All right, we have something called the 19th hole. You have a chance to ask me anything, and I might be honest, and I might not. So tee it up.
What explains your love affair with Peter Costas?
This is 35, 36 years ago. And I belonged to a great course in New Jersey called Hollywood. And we had a home down on the Jersey, near the Jersey Shore. And I'm turning 50. And so my wife, you know Connie well, I mean, she does all this research and she comes up with this idea that I need a golf lesson for the first time in my life at the age of 50. She scours all, talks to all of my friends, and comes up with the name of Peter Costas, who's going to come to New Jersey for the weekend. It just so happened, I don't think you know this end of the story. I was working at a current affair, and I had this exclusive interview with Sammy Davis Jr., but he was at the Royal St. Albert Hall in London
London, right.
performing, and so I had to go there on a Friday or a Thursday to interview him. And then on Friday, I was supposed to interview him. Now I'm supposed to see Costas this weekend and I'm in London. And I said, screw it. I paid the money, took the Concorde, got back to New York. Connie picked Peter up at the Newark airport on Friday night, and Saturday morning I was there in order to get the golf lesson. And that's when it all
But
started.
you know, it's sort of exhausting when you play with you and suddenly you're hitting balls, and suddenly there's Peter on a Zoom behind you saying,
Of
"You're taking
course.
two back to the outside." And these straps he puts you in, he wraps you up. I mean, my God, I mean, I got a boot on my feet, and you know, because of my broken ankles.
If anybody out there has seen Tin Cup, which you
Yeah,
have, all right. So when Costner in his character gets the shanks, all the various equipment that he puts on is Costas's equipment.
that's right.
And so in order to cure the shanks in Tin Cup, that's what Kevin did.
All right, let me ask you something. If you had your entire life to do all over again, I mean, your dad, can I tell about the two greatest lines your dad ever wrote from my
Sure.
standpoint? We have enough time.
Sure.
Every time I think of Shirley Povich, and I was fortunate enough to have met him and sat through baseball games, two of the greatest lines: George Preston Marshall, the owner of the Redskins at that time, was a racist, and the Redskins were the last team to ever have a black football player. So one Sunday, Shirley's column after the game was, "And so here on Sunday in our nation's capital, the Redskins roared onto the field wearing their traditional gold, burgundy, and Caucasian." Another time, Jimmy Brown scored five touchdowns against the Redskins in Washington, and Shirley says, "And so here in our nation's capital Sunday, the great Jimmy Brown integrated the Redskins end zone five times."
Yeah.
I mean, who writes like that anymore?
Yeah.
Nobody.
Yeah.
Nobody.
Well, you know, I believe it or not, contacted your dear friend the other day, Dan Shaughnessy.
Right.
Well, Shaughnessy writes like that.
Oh, he did. But Dan's one of the few, you know what I mean? And he's great. Now, Dan and I communicate by email by the hour, it seems. He probably told you that. I'm always sending him thoughts and talking about his columns. He's great, you know. But let me tell you something. I don't know anybody who has the cojones that he has, because he writes for a paper owned by the owner of the Red Sox, and he rips the hell out of the Red Sox and the owner all the time. And every time he says, "And the Red Sox, owned by John Henry, parenthesis, who also owns the Globe, comp, parenthesis," I mean, he rips the hell out of the team.
So why
By the
can't you think that somebody at ESPN can do the same thing to the NFL?
I think the economic implications are staggering.
Oh, because of that.
I think, well, there'll be stir, there'll be things, but I'd like to find out what really happened here on the Kaepernick thing, you know.
So, did you know Cosell at all?
Humble Howard. I was walking on the train one night when I lived up in Connecticut, going home one night, and Howard was playing his card game. I loved Howard. We used to get together with Walter Kennedy, myself, Howard, and Carl Lindemann, have dinners about once a month, believe it or not, in Connecticut when I was a young writer. I'm walking down the train, and Howard said, "And here he comes, ladies and gentlemen, the lowest form of life here in our country, a print journalist, Mark Mulvoy." And I looked at him and I said, "And there he is, ladies and gentlemen, Humble Howard Cosell, the man who says, tell it like it is, but never does. And the man who today is wearing a rug that's not the same rug that he wore
Yeah,
yesterday." He gave me
that.
five and we moved on.
I did the same thing with him when he wrote the book, Tell It Like It Is, and he came on a local show that I was doing in Washington called Panorama.
I
I
liked Howard.
introduced him as
I loved his wife.
Howard Cosell, man who changed his name, wears a toupee, and wrote a book called Tell It Like It Is. He did not like that.
No.
But the reason I bring that up, I think Stephen A. Smith has reinvented himself into the 2025 version of Howard.
I don't disagree. I do think if I were running ESPN, I would cut down on his appearances a little bit. I mean, you know, it's fine to hear his volatility and his outrageousness and whatever it might be, but I don't think we need it for every event that's on ESPN every day. You know, I pick our moments a little. I take about
So do
20%.
you think Stephen? You think Steven has the gall to criticize the NFL at times or not?
I think we'll find out. You know, I mean, it's a new
You
game. The new
think
game doesn't begin till next year, by the way.
I understand, but
Yeah.
do you think that the ESPN management would come down on him or the Disney management?
It's a good, I don't know. It also depends on who the ESPN management is in another year. You know, two of my neighbors here in Rye, Tom Murphy and Dan Burke, you know, they owned, you know, ESPN and everything else like that. And yeah, they didn't like controversy, I can tell you.
Do you know who the great winner of ESPN is? Year after year, the biggest winner, the Hearst organization.
Well, they're the ones who bought the piece of that we didn't get. Sean Bratches is the CFO of ESPN for a long time. He used to call me and tell me what the bottom line. He says, "Well, we made $7.2 billion this year. We sent a check to them for $1.755 billion.
And my
One
friend,
year for $100,000 investment."
right. My friend John Connemicks, who ran all the Hearst television stations, just smiles every time I mention the fact that they own 20% of
Oh, and that was
ESPN.
sports. We kept Levin and everything. You guys talked. We talked about getting into some type of visual video stuff, and HBO. Michael Fuchs wouldn't talk to us at HBO, so he wouldn't answer your phone call. So I said to Levin, but he wouldn't spend the 100 million. And if he had time, I wonder if Time Inc. would still be alive today, considering they have an infusion of at least $1 billion a year for the last 30 years from ESPN.
But the big news about that is it's all profit. They don't have to have one dime
Nothing. They
cost,
don't have
not
any
one.
people assigned to it. They get a check every year. Oh, thank you very. Oh, didn't bounce. Off they go to the bank. In fact, Sean said to me 1 year they made a lot of money, and they asked Hearst if they'd let them have 300,000, 300 million to do some. They were doing something with the facility. ESPN, take whatever you want because they're making so much money.
Everyone, I want to thank Mark for being with me today. It's just been great. You're my dear old friend.
Thanks, Murray. Nice being with you. I'm sorry when you come back east, we won't be able to play golf. I'm out of action, as you know.
I
I had
know. I mean,
accident.
some summer you've had, kid.
Yeah, well, I'm going down a hill in a golf cart. I left my foot out, it dangled, it broke the ankle in a couple of places.
Why would
We'll be
you?
in
I mean, I
Florida.
tell my 30-year-old.
I
I
know.
tell my 30-year-old, put your feet back in the cart. What are you
I
doing?
know, please. I'm Irish. Like Billy Conn once said, what's the use of being Irish if you can't be dumb? Leave it at that. We'll play in Florida, though. We look forward to being back in Florida in about
I'll
2 months.
see you then.
All right. Thank you. Say
Bye,
hello to
my man.
Connie, please.
I will do. Please give my love to Trish.
Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
If you've had as much fun as I did, make sure you subscribe to On Par with Maury Povich on YouTube and tap that little bell so you don't miss a thing. And if you like to listen on the go, we're on Apple, Spotify, everywhere you get your podcast. Hit that follow button. I'll be back with more before you know it. On Par with Me, Maury Povich, is brought to you by Mopo Productions, A Better Life Media, and Radley Studios, with executive producers me, Maury Povich, Holly J. Mirabella, and Christian Thompson, supervising producer Mike Bournasian.